got my automatic level on. So we'll leave it at that. Dr. Kevin Danaher, welcome back to the Isle of Man. I suppose it's inevitable that I should start by asking you about the Irish Folklore Commission with whom you worked so long. Tell me how it came about in the first place.
Well, in 1925 and 26, numbers of people were becoming more and more concerned with the fact that in many parts of Ireland, the Irish language was dying out, and that the tradition of the language was going with it. And you had a number of people got together and started a society, a voluntary society, called the Folklore Society of Ireland. I'm sorry, the Folklore of Ireland Society. Folklore of Ireland Society. We usually refer to it in the Gaelic name, Cumann Béilla de Saerin. And as a result of the work of that voluntary society and the publication of a magazine by it, a journal, Bialidis, a certain quantity of material came together. People began to collect material, or people began to dig about in their attics to find things which their parents, their grandparents, or somebody had written down from the oral tradition of the past, and a quantity of material of this kind came together so that finally they prevailed upon the state to provide a small body called called the Folklore Institute, in order to take care of this material. That was in 1931-32, and 3-4 years later, in 1935, the state was further persuaded. Persuasion wasn't very difficult at the moment. At the time, the head of state was Mr. De Valera, who was very, very interested in material of this kind. And he decided to set up what was known then as the Irish Folklore Commission, primarily established for 5 years with a certain financial support, whose task was to record and preserve traditional material. Now, they were lucky in obtaining the services of a certain Mr. Sean O'Sullivan, whose name is widely known and widely revered all over the world wherever studies of this kind are in progress, because he codified for the first time in the English language, in a work called A Handbook of Irish Folklore, he codified the definition of what folklore is and asked all the questions that are to be asked if one is interested in it, running to 700 pages or more. Mm-hmm. Now, as one knows, tradition, folk tradition, as defined by O'Sullivan, and indeed as defined by any person who is interested in ethnological survey and research, it is a very defined very, very widely indeed, because it's defined by the method of transmission in everything. Everything which is transmitted traditionally is tradition. Entirely apart or independent of whatever subject it may be, so that there isn't any aspect of human thought or of human endeavour, human speech, human action, which cannot be included in tradition insofar as it has been transmitted traditionally, so that it ranges very, very widely from the most humdrum thing, from house building and fire irons and ploughing fields, to the most metaphysical flights of belief and of custom and of magic and so on. Mm. Now, not everybody was immediately converted to this. Because when the good Mr. De Valera visited the Isle of Man in 1947 and was interested to meet and to hear some of the older Manx speakers there, and hearing some of the difficulties in the preservation, or at least the preservation of the memory of the language, he promised his help in recording the last of the Manx speakers, and when he returned to Ireland, he applied to the Irish Folklore Commission as somebody engaged in, a body engaged in similar work, to go to the Isle of Man and, with recording apparatus, and make the required recordings. And the good man was astonished and indeed horrified to find out that the Folklore Commission didn't have any such apparatus, because they didn't hadn't interested themselves hitherto in it, although some of us who were working in the thing had been experimenting with this and waiting and praying for the day when we would get the financial support required for it. Well, when the head of a government is interested in something, usually something happens, and wheels turned, and wheels perhaps within wheels turned, and before very, very long money was available, so that we set up a recording unit. It was a disc-cutting unit. You got 16-inch discs, each of which had 15 minutes on each side, or 30 minutes on the whole disc.
If I could just sort of butt in here, when had your association begun with the commission?
Oh, my own began in 19... what is association? Was the first time it heaves in sight, the first time it becomes within your ken, so to speak.
Yes.
When I was a second year student in University College Dublin, that would have been in 35, coming up to second year examination, 34, 35, that's quite right. Mm. I was asked, I was a student of archaeology at the time, I was doing some voluntary work in the National Museum, I was asked by the director of the museum, would I go to Connacht in the company of a well-known Swedish ethnologist, Dr. Åke Campbell, in order to assist him there for a fortnight or 3 weeks when he was doing a study of the more physical, material side, as it were, of the folk tradition. The which I did. This began to interest me in it. And as a result of that and of the interest that the director of the National Museum, he was German, he was an Austrian, really, Dr. Adolf Mahr, and between them they persuaded me and persuaded the necessary authorities that I should go to Germany on a scholarship in order to study the mechanics of ethnology, folk tradition. Volkskunde, Volksleben, as it was called then. So I was very, very lucky in being granted a Humboldt scholarship for 2 years to go under the Humboldt Stiftung to go to Germany, the which I did. Now, I returned towards the end of July in 1939, when the balloon was just about to go up, which effectively interrupted a great deal of academic and work in Europe, with the result that I found myself for the next 4 or 5 years in uniform. And it wasn't until 1945 that I began to... that I was able to take up my work again, because I had been appointed as a collector of the Irish Folklore Commission in February of 1940. I was called to adopt military service in May of 1940. And it was 1945 by the time that the thing was over and we got out again into civilian life, at which time I went back to work for the Irish Folklore Commission, first of all as a field worker, but afterwards more and more in organising the wider ethnological surveys for the Folklore Commission. And gradually I became the person who did things there, so that when sound recording was envisaged, I was the person who did the sound recording. When photographic recording was necessary, I did the photographic recording. When the making of 16mm films was there, I did that, and so on and so forth. So I was a person selected to do this. So we built our own recording van. That is, naturally, we didn't make the engine or the transmission of it, but we fitted the thing up with the apparatus. We were using all sorts of peculiar methods. One had to work from batteries and converters, because one was working outside the scope of the normal electrical grid, usually. Things are different nowadays. You can plug in your tape recorder almost anywhere. It's not far too easy, in other words. Mm. You had to balance the turntables so that your record was running absolutely level. We used to use a carpenter's spirit level for doing that. And you use pieces of rock and driftwood and things like that to prop up the apparatus, so that it was. We had to get the speed absolutely right. Now, if you are dealing with a fixed standard grid, you can usually, that's the ordinary 50 cycle grid, you can get your speed right. In other words, the speed from one source, one electrical socket, will be the same as the speed derived from the any other electrical socket in the same grid. But when you're dealing with batteries and converters, you never know whether it's going fast or slow, because you have to use, in that case, a rheostat in order to fast or slow. And what we did was, this is our own idea, we got a record disc cut to one true note. I remember it was a middle C in the New Philharmonic scale. And you used a tuning fork in the same in order to balance the thing perfectly. And you can get it. We tested it. We tested it ourselves. And was I found to my surprise that I was rather good. I had a rather good ear. I could get it very, very close. Indeed, so close that in the tune that, that nobody could distinguish. So this is the way we did it, and this is the way we did it. And we brought the thing over to the Isle of Man, having tested it out. This was our really our first. In those days it was an adventure. I drove down in the about 11 o'clock in the evening and had the recording van slung from a crane and dropped into the hold of a cattle boat which was coming over to Douglas, and then the cattle came in and they occupied the upper deck, and what shall I say, the effluent descended upon the lower deck, so that in the morning it was rather difficult to see where the van was, especially as the van was a sort of a dark green colour and was more or less camouflaged completely. So I succeeded in getting into the van without too much disturbance, and then drove it from the harbour here in Douglas, where incidentally we were received by the Chief Preventive Officer, Mr. Kinvig, who helped us very, very much indeed, was very, very good to us, and drove up to the Manx Museum to be greeted with horror by the director thereof, Basil McGaw, a gentle soul who was somewhat perturbed to see the state in which we were. And he called to me from a distance, from a safe distance. He said, "Don't get out and close the windows." And he summoned a stout fellow with a strong hose who hosed the thing down and succeeded in washing it fairly clean. And then we were ready to go ahead. Yes. And we spent some weeks going up and down the island, meeting people, working with them. Very happy memories of that, of the people who helped us at the time, of John Gell down in Port St. Mary, and of Bill Radcliffe from Ramsey, Leslie Quirk, who happily is still with us, from Peel, and the various others, Arthur Carron and Charles Crane and Mark Braid and Tom Braid and the rest of them who worked with us. Eric Cregeen, such a fine fellow, and his sister Sheila, who helped us, and the old people we went to, very happy memories of those, of such friendly people. Ned Madrill probably was the chief one, but there also was in Godot John Neen from Balaf, and John Tom Cachin, who was a blind man from the north side of the island too, a very, very nice and gentle person, and Harry Boyd, who was a tremendously fluent speaker of Manx, tremendously fluent speaker. In fact, the difficulty was to get him to stop talking, not to get him, and several others. I mean, we had a delightful meeting there in whose house was it, at the south end of the island, across the South Barool, let me think now, where half a dozen of the old people got together and had a tremendous evening there talking. And also on another occasion we brought Ngozo over to meet John Tom Cachan, and the two of them sat down and conversed in Manx, because the old people at the time didn't have very, very much opportunity to speak to their contemporaries. I mean, difficulties of travel and so on, and to speak to their contemporaries and get into the, you know, the same natural fluency which they had. And of course, when you got these two old boys going, it certainly was worth listening to. We recorded at least part of their conversation.
Were you able to speak to them in Irish? Did you understand?
I understood the greater part of it. I could follow the stories and so on. Now, there always is a difficulty with that, because if one is literary in a language, one can visualize the words as they come, but the person who is not used to reading in the language, as very few of the old people were, couldn't so easily understand the slight dialectic difference that I was using. If I spoke very carefully and they thought for a while, they could understand practically every word, but ordinary conversation would be, by the time they'd have got the word, the speaker would have gone 10 words forward. Mm-hmm. You see, yes. Mm-hmm. But I found it, after a while, quite easy to understand. Some of them, I understood John Tom Cachan very well, and I understood Ned Madrill extremely well. Mm. Harry Boyd and Ngozo, they were fairly rapid speakers, and they usually got ahead. But if one listened carefully, I can still remember some of the stories even that they told.
Yes.
And some of the verses and some of the, yes.
Some of the stories, did you find that there were other parallels?
Oh, of course, yeah. Yes, there were. Some of them were ordinary, small folk tales which one finds in other parts of the world. And some of them were the traditions and the beliefs and the customs and all the rest of it. I mean, calendar affairs and so on, descriptions of hunting the Ran and of Midsummer Day and all the rest of it. They were just versions of the much more widely known tradition of Western Europe. Yes. Oh, yes.
So you made these. Were there any particular surprises about this trip? Did you come with any preconceived ideas at all?
No, I didn't, because I'd never been in the Isle of Man before. And I had, of course, a good deal of experience in the field already with old people at home in Ireland. So in that way, there was. It was very, very much the same. The people were very, very much the same, and the way they felt and the way they thought and the way they spoke.
Yes.
And the things which interested them and the things which excited them and so on were very, very much the same as those which would all have applied to our own old people, the same kind of people. And if you had transported some of our old people from the Isle of Man over into a village community, let us say in Ireland, they find themselves absolutely and perfectly at home. There was practically nothing different.
Yes. Yes. So you took these recordings back to Ireland. What did Mr. De Valera express any interest after?
Oh, he did, yes, and he wanted wanted to hear some of it. Now, being a busy man, he couldn't sit down and listen to the lot, but we made some small excerpts to which he could listen. Yes, and he was interested in it. He was quite interested in, he was a scholarly sort of a man, he was interested in linguistic forms and so on, in word comparison and etymologies and things like that, so that he was the Manx version of things, it interested him.
Yes.
As I say, he had very little time to devote to it.
And of course these recordings now play a major part in the Manx Language Society's archive, don't they?
Well, yes, that is good, because it was the first really audible sound recording there. Now, there had been some sound. Were they sound recordings? There had been some recordings made as dictation aids, formerly, on dictation machines, in which you could hear, as it were, vaguely in the distance, some language being spoken, but these recordings, they were good. They were as good as most studio recordings are, and I must say that they were, on the whole, a great deal better than most tape recordings are made nowadays, because it was difficult. It was hard work. You had to get your heavy apparatus there, and you had to set it up carefully, and you had to balance it, and you had to carry out microphone tests and all sorts of things. In other words, you made sure that you were making good recordings. Sound recording nowadays with tape recorders is much too easy, and people do not take sufficient care of, you know, monitoring background noise. We are used to primitive things for this. We didn't have any instruments. You closed both eyes and one ear in order to monitor the background noise, and then you heard all the background noise.
Yes.
So that they're good recordings, and they were the first the first good voice recording is made in the Isle of Man. A great deal has been done since then by devoted people with, you know, the more modern things, tape recorders and so on, and the material mounts up, but these were the first. And so from that point of view, at least, they were of some importance. Also of some importance is that they are the only recordings of some of the people who were... the people to whom we interviewed at the time had passed on to their award before the new apparatus came in.
Yes, yes. Now, coming up to date, of course, now the Irish Folklore Commission is attached to...
Well, the Irish Folklore Commission was abolished in the year 1970. And after a year in, what shall I say, of indecision, a year in limbo, it was decided that the enormous quantity of material which had been collected by it, it really is a vast quantity of material. It's one of the biggest folk tradition archives in the world. There's something like 2 million pages of notation in it, and thousands of hours of sound recording, and a very, very large collection of photographic and illustrative material, and so on and so forth. And all of this had to be disposed of in some way when the Folklore Commission came to an end. Folklore Commission was never a permanent institution. It was always temporary and had its life renewed from time to time. And of course, I mean to say, a temporary nature of that kind means a certain degree of indecision about the future and what you can do. And then you were up against diminishing returns and various other aspects of the thing which made its, brought its life to an end. It was decided that something must be done to this great collection. Some thoughtful people also thought that research on the material should really begin. Publication of the material should be envisaged, and particularly that people should be trained in the handling of the material. And taking all that into consideration, they decided that the proper place for it, the proper milieu, was the academic one, and it was handed over to University College Dublin, which began to organise then as a research and a teaching department, with the result that we have the research has been formalised and extended, and the teaching function has also been carried on, so that we have perhaps over the past 10 years or so about 40 or thereabouts young people who are fully qualified now, who are in this particular thing, in ethnological research.
Yes.
Not all of them have followed that. We see some of the teachers. One is a dramatic producer, and a couple of librarians, and so on and so forth. But there are trained people now to carry on the work, so that when the time for expansion comes, you will have people who are able to do this. Incidentally, it is the only university in these islands which has a qualification, a degree, in a primary degree in ethnology, folk tradition. This is a very, very common thing, and the continent of Europe is taken as just as commonplace as degrees in, let us say, in geography or history or archaeology are in Britain or in Ireland. But it's spreading now. We have recently in the Department of History in University College Cork, there's a section now dealing with the oral tradition, with the folk tradition. Recently, 2 years ago, University College Galway began to include it in one of their departments, and this very year I have been invited by, and I'm doing at the moment, to start a course in St. Patrick's University in Maynooth. So that it is spreading, and that in Ireland. It's rather a pity that in nowhere in Britain is there a full university department dealing with this material. The School of Scottish Studies is doing splendid work in Edinburgh and is working towards the state where you will have a quite independent university department, or possibly faculty, working upon this. But as far as I know, although in University College London and in Leeds and in one or two other places in Britain, you have certain concessions to, what shall we say, to the traditional history of agriculture, or to what is now popularly known as oral history or something of that kind. There still is no university which has an independent department teaching folk tradition, folklore, archaeology, ethnology, or whatever it's way one may term it. And there is, I do not think there is any country on the continent of Europe which doesn't have somewhere or other a university department dealing with this. And in many countries, such as in Germany and Scandinavia, one has almost every university has a department which deals with the traditions of the ordinary people. And this, of course, is, I think, vital to the intellectual development in any country, that you pay attention to the tradition, you let the ordinary people speak for themselves. The ordinary people in town and in country, their hopes, their ambitions, their traditions, their feeling about it, their, indeed you can assess the public public opinion of the past by examining their traditions.
Yes.
All of which is very, very valuable indeed.
Well, following on from that, what do you think, if anything, we in the Isle of Man, perhaps in a smaller way, how can we follow through on that?
Now, in any enterprise of this kind, you will find four stages in the work. You have to go out and do the original field work. You have to have the preservation and the cataloguing and the arrangement of the material. You have to have research on the whatever parts of it seem suitable. And you have to have the final exposition of it in various ways. Now, I think that there is scope for work here in all of these. Now, they has begun already in all of it. It needs expansion in this. I think a good deal more field work could be done. A great deal more interviewing the older citizens particularly, and finding out what their traditions of the past were. A good deal of observation of people, of this whatever survivals there are, the dying survivals of people's the ordinary way of life, their methods and their tools and their actions and their beliefs and their customs and all the rest of it, insofar as these still find expression. We are already versed, as you are versed, on the matter of the, you know, the preservation and segregation and so on. Research will solve itself, because if you have material, something will be done about it. It'll be studied in some way. People will become interested in it, in whatever form they do. The exposition is a point which requires as much attention as the original fieldwork, because you can have exposition on several levels. I mean, you can have everything from the university lecture to the popular lecture on television or on radio. To popular printing of books, articles, and so on, to popular instruction in the schools. And I think this is very, very important as an important part of the children's, young people's study of their environment. They should be led to take interest in the traditions of their own people, in what was happening long ago in the lives of ordinary people. I think that is just as important as their knowing the, you know, the political history of the past or constitutional history or what have you. As some English historian, was it Acton, put it, to go into the workshops and into the kitchens of history and see how ordinary people lived. Because after all, most people are ordinary people, and most people's background is the ordinary people's background, and most people's ancestry is ordinary people's ancestry. And you would like to know them, not to be learning all the time about other people, but to be learning about yourself and about your own people. I think that's important. I think that makes for continuity, it makes for self-respect and self-reliance, and I think in many ways that it is commendable. It has been found so in most countries in Europe where these studies are being actively promoted, and I think that it would be a very, very good idea if they were included in the ordinary school curricula, as well as being made available to the public in whatever palatable form people would like to accept.
Dr. Kevin Danaher, thank you very much indeed for your time.